This is how to secure Apache Spark, basically Apache Spark on a secure environment. My name is Nilesh. I work for Cloudera. And as a customer operations engineer, I end up looking at a lot of customer problems, mostly within the realm of data processing frameworks such as Spark and Yarn. And some of this came up over 3 months ago about security and Spark. Essentially, it's the problems that we've seen around the area of security and Spark itself. So I made this talk in order to understand how to set up things correctly and also talk about issues that we've hit, and at least on the customer side, and what issues we've seen develop because of Spark and security itself. So to talk about what my sort of outline is, I want to go ahead with an overview of security in the cluster in general. Talk about pieces that are part of security itself, and then focus on the setup of security itself, like Kerberos on HDFS, talk about Yarn and security itself, and Spark on Yarn with security. And also, I want to discuss about the possible issues that we hit over the while that we looked at the problems coming in from our customer side, and I want to note down a few problems and mention it out here so that just sharing the experience of understanding how problems are. So before we move forward, familiarity with Spark, anybody? Do you have, okay, cool. And then whenever we have time towards the end, if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. So starting with security, authentication itself is basically verifying the identity of a user, identifying whether user X is indeed user X. And this needs to be done in order to maintain that level of security in a system so that you identify who the user is. Now, our environment is essentially the CDH environment where a ton of users use different kinds of resources, they access different services, and to enable security, especially in the authentication side of things, we use Kerberos. I'll go in details with Kerberos later on, but to mention on a higher level, it's done on network on the network layer, especially with the objects like the KDC and the client and the servers, as Kerberos is, mythologically speaking. There's OS verification, there's LDAP, there's SAML. SAML is essentially used between Cloudera Manager, Navigator Encrypt, and Hue. We're not going into details of that. That's sort of internal, and it's part of the part of the system. But I want to focus more on Kerberos in this session itself. So the next would be authorization, which is essentially a part after, if you will, from authentication, which you understand this person X is person X, and then now the understanding is if this person has the rights to do certain things or access a certain service, depending on their membership or permissions in their groups. So like Hadoop user, group authorization, Sentry, LDAP, the essential idea is to make sure that this user, after identification, has the membership of the group or any kind of rules that the user has to apply to get into a system or access a certain detail of a system. So imagine identifying a user and identifying if the group matches to that user and if part of the group and certain privileges, so on and so forth. So also not going into details with this, which this is more of the authorization part with Sentry and LDAP as well that is part of the ecosystem and can be used to enable authorization on the cluster. So talking about encryption, which is done both at rest and on the wire, which is KeyTrustee and the key management service and Navigator Encrypt, essentially you can enable on the wire encryption with you need encryption because despite you having firewalls, you need data to be encrypted coming in and out, so enabling encryption is necessary eventually in a system, maybe not in the beginning, but you would need to have something like TLS or something set up or RPC encryption enabled. There's HDFS encryption at rest as well, and over the wire you can do something like TLS. So I want to go over the main pieces of the setup essentially, talking about the storage layer, which is HDFS, the cluster resource manager, which is Yarn, and then the data processing layer, which is Spark, and security essentially with Kerberos, which covers all three of them in a broader fashion. So this is sort of a logical view of how things are and at least giving you an idea of how things are set up, and that's how I'm going to go with. So let's begin with Kerberos in general. So what is it? taking from the mythological meaning of the dog that guards the hell, gates of hell, if you will, and the three parts are the KDC, the client, and the server. So I want to explain over the concepts of how it works, and then I have a couple of slides that talk about the flow and giving you more understanding in how things work in Kerberos itself. So in a principle, principle is the entity that defines a certain service in the Kerberos realm. So the principles essentially contain three portions. There's primary, there's an instance, and a realm. So primary essentially can be a string, an arbitrary string, which can be a username or service. An instance can be optional, which can either be an additional service name and part of the realm itself. And the realm is, imagine if you want to do like a lookup for DNS, which is a host. In DNS, you have host names. Here you have realms, which are essentially a collection of services that point to a certain KDC for that setup. So it can be a realm with multiple KDCs depending on how your setup is. So KDC is the key distribution center, which is the authority of authentication in part of a Kerberos setup. Now, keytab is essentially containing the pairs of principles. Now, keytabs can be passed over by which can be needed to actually authenticate in the event of a user submitting a job or accessing a service. So the keytab is validated in order to actually get that access and authenticate the user in general. So, and this keytab is essentially passed on or at least stored in a specific place where it can actually be accessed and specified, hey, this is the keytab that gives me access to go forward and get the access to the service. Now, delegation tokens are basically a container of a token which represents the message for the client to the server specifying the owner ID, the renewal, the issue date, the max date, and sequence number. And I'll explain why this is important, but essentially this is the format of how a delegation token is involved, which is also needs to be authenticated first and then renewed over a period of time depending on how the life of it is. And this enables a service or a user to essentially talk to a service and get authenticated by means of a token. So going to the authentication process itself, let's say a client wants to authenticate with a server. So let's take a client, whatever the client is, and let's say the name node on the other side. It needs to talk to the name node, make sure it authenticates. So it passes the token ID to the name node, gets the token authenticator generated. The master key itself lives on the name node, persisted in memory. It doesn't have to generate the tokens each time. So when it has to generate the authenticator to make sure that it matches, and then finally, it does a check to validate the authentication when the current date or the current time itself is less than that of the max date, which is the validity of the token itself. So in the event you've authenticated it, you got the access, you're going on a session, and it comes a time where you need to renew the token. So in that process, let's say a resource manager is trying to connect to the name node. So what it does is it passes the token ID. Now, the key point here is the renewer ID. The name node verifies that this entity that's trying to renew is matching the same renewer ID in the token, and it looks at enables the authenticator, gets that with the master key that it already has, and verifies the date again to make sure the renewal time, basically making sure that the request is valid, and then updates the expiry time to a minimum of the current time plus the renewal period and the max date. So now you've renewed it. So to talk about, so these are the three components, of Kerberos itself. This is the KDC, the client, and the server. So I've broken it down to three steps, which is the setup, the authentication, and the message exchange. Now in the setup itself, is imagine the client needs to talk to a specific server, and this is only replies. Imagine requests as well. I wanted to simplify this, so I just kept the replies. So essentially, it's requesting a user key and with a server principal name, so it knows which server to access, and that sort of is the pre-setup phase of getting the session going. Now, once that is set up, it goes to the authentication phase where it actually requests some sort of session key to actually access what the server is. Now, the KDC here is the authority. It gives the session key or the service ticket. It knows which servers to actually go forward with. It gives it to the client. The client actually adds the token ID, the essential information that's needed, and then talks to the server. Now, the key point of Kerberos is essentially the KDC is not required each time. Once this authentication phase is complete, there's a trust set up between the client and the server itself, which means that the server can know that it's coming from X client because it can decrypt this message which was meant for it. So the server knows, hey, this client is sending me a request that only I can read. So the role of the KDC at this point becomes, it's not needed at this point because the server and the client have established a trust and they can talk to each other over a certain session. So once this authentication phase gets over, you end up, the client needs to talk to the server, it sends messages soon after, but you don't have to involve the KDC at this point because you've established this trust and you have this session, so you can communicate without the needing of an authority. So going a bit more deeper into how this works on a level that you can basically make more sense of it. So in this phase, the KDC is split with the authentication service, the ticket granting service. So the first step is actually getting to the ticket granting service, which I showed in the setup phase. So here, the authentication service becomes the KDC. The client itself is the client, and the ticket granting service is the server. So it has to first get the ticket granting ticket to actually talk to the ticket granting service so that it gets a service ticket eventually to the server that it needs to talk to. So the first phase goes to the authentication service. Again, it requests it, gets a TGT back, and talks to the ticket granting service. Once that is done, the specific server that it needs to talk to, a service, it points there from on, and then that continues on from the ticket granting service itself. So at the end, the ticket granting service becomes the KDC, the client and the server are as they are. So we've looked at the sort of understanding of how Kerberos is. Now the setup essentially is, I want to break it down and talk about just the setup and what needs to be done. So essentially installing CDH and Clutter Manager, that's a given. That's the environment to work with. Essentially, it makes it easier in terms of deploying the configurations, changing configs, adding more client properties, running jobs. So essentially installing CDH and CM are sort of a prerequisite. And you've done that, let's say you have your cluster and you just need to maintain the group permissions for these directories basically for HDFS and Yarn itself and making sure that these permissions are set correctly. You can also verify the type of encryption, maybe AES 256-bit or 128, depending on what you have. Now, initially, you need to set up a principle for the Cloudera Manager server itself, and that can be done by using the kadmin, which is essentially like the command kadmin would be applicable if the KDC itself is on a different host. If you're on the same host as the Cloudera Manager server and the KDC, you would use kadmin.local. So this would be adding a password, and you can give admin privileges to that Clutter SCM user, and this is the instance that I spoke of earlier in the part of a principle, and you can set that up as a principle for that so that the other services interact with it. Now, the wizard in Clutter Manager enables you to set up Kerberos itself to have Kerberos in the cluster itself. Now, the KDC conf will have the properties that go specifically with the KDC itself, and that can include the max life of a ticket, the renewable life, and ports for the KDC itself on the TCP. So that setup can go in initially in the wizard itself that you're running, and that makes life easier to throw it in there and have it, and it runs once you're setting up the KDC. The KRB5 configuration is essentially the file that holds all the realms and the domain, and the configuration that needs to be done in Kerberos itself. And Cloudera Manager enables you to make sure the KRB5 conf itself is propagated to all the hosts which are needed to access on Kerberos itself. And after that, configuring the data node ports for web access And finally, enabling Kerberos with the wizard. Once the wizard is complete, you can enable Kerberos and generate the credentials and start back your services. So you've done that, you've established Kerberos in the cluster, and now you want to actually run a job. So you would add something like a super user on HDFS and make sure that given you need to set up the principal and knit as that user itself. I would recommend using a stronger password because you're giving access to the HDFS directories for this user. So, and this is typically what, in an initial setup, it would be helpful to have this kind of super user or super user group so that you can run a typical job without having setting up anything else if there's nothing else set up. You can certainly add more users, of course, towards the end, but this would be sort of a start, and that's how you do it in terms of adding users onto your setup. Now, since we've set up Kerberos itself with HDFS, now the yarn bit comes into picture. So yarn itself has the components that are resource manager, node manager, and the MapReduce job history server, which also plays a role in the yarn ecosystem. The idea is to add, I wanted to list them, but they were too long, but essentially what you need to add is the key tab, which is, imagine like yarn.keytab, and place it in the etc Hadoop conf directory so that you have access to it. The principal itself, which may be yarn at host at realm, the Linux the container executor class, the Linux container executor group, which is essentially the Apache Hadoop, I don't remember the exact class name, which is the, yes, it's the Linux container executor class, and TLS if you need to enable on the web UI itself. You can keep it as HTTPS only for the policies on TLS. And the same goes for the MapReduce side XML, which needs to be having the job history address, the key tab, the principal, same for the job history server again, and TLS if you need to enable. And for the Linux container executor, you need a certain file. You need to create the container executor.config, which essentially tells Yarn about the local directories, the log directories, and also enables proxy using, talks about the groups as well. You can set up a specific restriction on groups or banning users, and that gives you the access to the containers itself. So once you've done this, starting these instances on Yarn itself will bring it up. And what I do essentially as sort of a litmus test would be running a pi job towards the end to verify the setup is correct. And that sort of makes sense in terms of after the setup. I've done this before when I had to install Kerberos, and finally the test was just running a pi job as a user and making sure things went correctly. If this runs, you're fine. So now we've finished Yarn, so let's go to Spark. So Spark is part of the ecosystem, and it's been there, and the security module is either Kerberos or a shared secret. So Kerberos authentication for Spark can be done through Yarn. Hence I went through the flow of actually having Yarn itself set up and then talking about Spark. So the configuration can be Yarn first and then not standalone. So you can submit your jobs on the Yarn cluster deployment mode. I'll talk about the creation, but then the understanding is the Spark submit command works on Yarn with the deployment mode to enable Kerberos. Now, the second would be to enabling and adding the principal and the key tab, which essentially mean the following, adding a key tab and the realm and the principal for Spark itself, which can be stored in etc Spark conf as opposed to the etc Hadoop conf that was in Yarn. And that needs to be, I mentioned changing ownership because it's a problem that we've seen before, and I'll talk about it in a future slide, but it's essentially having that ownership that is set up correctly so that you don't hit problems of access later on. Now, finally, we come to the history server itself, which is an instance on Spark itself, and you need to add the options for the history server, which enable it to be Kerberos authenticated, its principal, and its key tab itself. So you can do this by either appending the spark-nv.sh, which is the environment variables live in Spark that goes into that session. You can either do that, or you can add safety valves onto Cloudera Manager, or dash dash properties, which is dynamic and can be appended later on. I would personally recommend to do on safety valves. It's less riskier as opposed to adding it on dash NV, but it's fine as well if you're confirmed of the changes. So safety valves are a bit more overriding, so I would be it'd be more comfortable doing it on a safety valve. Now, running a Spark application similar to what we did on Yarn as a Pi job, you have Pi jobs as an example in Spark itself, and you can do that by either logging into Kerberos directly, which is already there, so you don't have to explicitly set up anything, and just talk to Kerberos as the user and making sure, of course, the user that's running is a Kerberos user or authenticated via Kerberos, and you can do that directly, or you can specify the key tab, which is essentially the key tab for Spark that we just created. The principal also, the key tab and the path, the full path of the key tab needs to be mentioned. The principal itself and the proxy user if necessary, if you need to impersonate and run it as a separate user. So this is sort of a few of the issues that we've seen while discussing Spark in general and talking about how we've seen problems in Spark and security. One of the issues, which a common symptom, was the GSS exception with no valid credentials, and this is why I mentioned the earlier part about having permissions of the key tab. This is essentially not having access to the key tab that is already generated. So having permissions enabled for the Spark key tab and then verifying with that username, let's say you have user HDFS, you have user whatever XYZ, and making sure that actually works on that domain and that in that realm, and that key tab is valid for that exact user. So this is essentially necessary to verify beforehand, so that you can remember before submitting a job, lest you can hit this. And I've seen issues coming up like this, so I wanted to mention this as one of the issues. So Hive and Spark has been also a part of the ecosystem for a while, so it's essentially imagining Hive, which is running on MapReduce, essentially replacing the execution engine and just putting in their Spark. So what the Hive Server 2 does, it invokes a Spark submit command or process once you fire a Hive query with the execution engine enabled as Spark. But since Kerberos is enabled, it needs then an extra credential for the Hive user to be present so that the Spark submit can actually run. So you need to establish a new credential so that you can actually run this via Spark itself. So what to do is to log in as root onto the Hive Server 2 instance, the host that has the Hive Server 2 instance, and then generate this Kerberos ticket temporarily for the Hive user so that you can actually enable this and gain access to Hive and get the job running itself, because Spark needs this essential token. So what happens in the process directory is you find that agent process and find the Hive service, and then you create you can it with that token, that key tab that you created for that hostname. Another problem that I've personally seen was the restriction of range of ports. So range of ports is essentially maintaining a fixed number of ports for access between the services. Now, in Spark, any call to a service would be service colon port in the API, but the problems, this specific use case came in when you have to restrict use cases or restrict access to the cluster with certain ports being open. So a customer was specifically asking about ranges, if they could open a certain range of ports to access a certain service. Now, what happens in the event of a failure is there's a component called max retries, which retries each of the services on a different number of ports. So the retry logic itself has port ranges from 1024 to 65,536, excluding all the privileged ports, but it would hit any random port, and if it's not open again, and as much as the retries are, you would still hit a failure each time you fail hitting a specific port. So it's easily done on a batch job, I guess, but setting up ports like the solution here mentions it specifically for each of the services. But in the event of like a streaming job, if something hits and misses in terms of getting access to a port, you're looking at multiple failures, and then you possibly have to restart again In a streaming job, it'll be more painful than so it is in batch. So that's sort of, and the ideology between the fix was that it would break a lot of backwards compatibility stuff. So the Jira never actually went into production or into the code because it would break a lot of the calls in the previous version of Spark. So that's something that came up as a topic on the Spark Jira itself. So this is one of the solutions. It's a bit hacky, I guess, for the bad job, but in the streaming world, it'd be more useful, and it'd be good to be more cautious on the streaming side of things. The long-running applications failing. So this happens in the event of if a ticket cannot be renewed or a token expiry. Basically, the job's running for, okay, if it runs for 6 days, there's a max lifetime of 7 days, you get renewed, it's fine. But if it goes, typically jobs, if they're running daily or if they're running in a long range after 7 days, then you're looking at not being able to renew the ticket from HDFS itself so that you can keep running the job. So what happens in the event of the key tab, when you pass the key tab, what it goes to the application master that essentially runs the driver of the program, and this is passed to the application, it's from the application master to the application master from using the Hadoop distributed cache, and that holds the token itself, and that passes on to the executors that run on the containers. So the objective is to actually enable proxy users so that it goes to the resource manager itself, and Yarn can take care of what the to renew the tokens after 7 days. So you don't have to wait for the job itself to do anything in terms of renewal, and the job can run, and because the renewal process has been proxied over to Yarn so that it can behave and run the renewal process with the name node itself. So enabling either enabling it to true, enabling the host a star. If you don't want a restriction, please you can name it a star. If you want restricted access to proxy users of certain hosts, you can name that as well. And even proxy user Yarn groups, you can also limit that on your setup as well, which will enable. It'll fix the problem. It just makes sure that you give the right access. If you're giving it to a certain group, only that can access it eventually when the need comes to renew the token. So that's pretty much it. I want to give credit to my colleagues who sort of gave me feedback and helped me work with the presentation. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Thank you for attending. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them. If not, thank you.
Kerberos and all of that stuff, and without all of these tricky things like creating manual key tabs, putting all the stuff on the hosts.
Yep.
And for example, if you have like 1,000 nodes, how much time it will take?
1,000 nodes in your cluster?
Yeah.
So it depends, I guess, on network, because the essential part is to transfer all the KRBFi conf essentially, which is deployed on the host. I guess network bandwidth would be your limit. Just to try.
Yeah, like you maybe had experience, you tried like on a big cluster, like 5 days, 3 days, 2 days.
To update?
I mean, to enable Kerberos, because you have not only to put all the things on their places, but also have to stop everything.
Yes. So stopping is essential in the beginning, and then setting it up and then bringing up the cluster is the time that it takes. I've not played around with 1,000 node clusters essentially, but I believe it would be network bound and it would take the essential time. Like restarting a cluster can be tricky, bringing up all the services, taking the time it takes, and all the. It depends on how your setup is. Yes, I've seen things fail as well. So. It will all depend on how the setup is, essentially. Yes, you're right.
I mean, maybe you tried with like 100 hosts or just some time frame that it takes. I don't know, 10 hosts.
Probably, I couldn't tell what time actually, because it depends on a lot of configurations, and some of them, if the some of the health reports are failing, or like timeout sometimes. So you have that sort of delay. It depends. I've seen, and you can, I don't know if you can quote me or anything, but maybe like 5-10 minutes for a 10 node cluster, I guess. Just an estimate, I guess.
Okay.
Yep. Yes. Come again.
How would you go on to implement authorization for your Spark cluster?
So authorization on the basic level, I don't think Sentry works correctly with the Spark as yet. But if there's work on, I'm not familiar with that. But at the basic level, just LDAP and OS group permissions, I guess, that you can restrict onto the user itself. Probably bound them by group permissions onto certain directories or certain access points, I would say. So on a basic level, that would be how would you implement. All right. All right, thank you.
Thank you.